Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Real Love podcast series, right here on the Sharon Salzberg Metta Hour. This series features a variety of conversations with some of the world's finest teachers and thinkers, all exploring Sharon's new book, Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection. Real Love is a field guide for anyone seeking awakened living in the 21st century. To get your copy of Real Love, visit SharonSalzberg.com. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please visit www.BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and today I'm speaking to Dr. Emma Seppala. Emma is the Science Director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford University and co-director of the Yale College Emotional Intelligence Project at Yale University. She's the founder of the popular news site Fulfillment Daily, which I look at quite a lot, and a frequent contributor to Psychology Today, Harvard Business Review, and the Washington Post. Emma is the author of a wonderful book. It's called The Happiness Track, How to Apply the Science of Happiness to Accelerate Your Success, and has conducted groundbreaking research on mind-body practices for combat veterans and in the fields of meditation and compassion. I've known Emma now for many years, and I'm so thrilled to get to speak to you today as part of my podcast series for my new book, Real Love. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Sharon. I'm touched and honored to be here with you.
We just saw each other recently at Kripalu Yoga Center, where we were both teaching. And I'm so glad we have this time today to talk about love and all the inspiring work that you yourself are doing. So let me start with talking about The Happiness Track, which was a wonderful book. Came out not that long ago. How long ago was that?
About a year or so.
Yeah. And tell me if love figured in your analysis of happiness, and if so, how?
Yes. Well, first of all, the book itself was an act of love that stemmed from seeing a pain point in people's lives, that pain point being burnout, fatigue, stress, exhaustion, mm-hmm. that I saw not just in high achievers, but starting to see everywhere, and how we've bought into this idea that the only way to be successful is to run ourselves into the ground, which is really an act of lack of self-love, and it's sort of an idea that you can't really take care of yourself if you want to achieve your dreams and be successful. And when I looked at the data, I saw that was weird. We've got it all wrong. And I really wanted to show that. So the book is hopefully a demonstration of that. And in terms of how love figures into happiness, it does so tremendously. And in fact, there are two ways of thinking of happiness in scientific terms. I mean, one way to do so is to think about it in terms of pleasure, which I often define as sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But it could also be money, it could be power, fame, any of those material things that give you that short little burst, that little high, that little feeling of joy. But it doesn't last very long. We all know that wonderful piece of chocolate, it doesn't last. And that wonderful, that wonderful feeling you get from getting a raise or a promotion or your 15 minutes of fame, soon thereafter, you're left craving for more. And so that is one type of happiness, which is called hedonic happiness, which is really the pleasures of the senses. But again, fame, money, all the material goods can fit under that. The other type of happiness is eudaimonic happiness, which is more the type of happiness that's derived from a life of service, pleasure, love, meaning, compassion. And that kind of happiness lasts. That kind of happiness leads to a life of fulfillment, not just happiness, but a life of fulfillment. And yet, all the marketing executives want us to focus on hedonic happiness. Hey, buy this car. Hey, buy this cream. You're going to look sexy. Hey, do this, do that. All these things that are supposedly going to give you those short bursts of joy. And yet, really, the best things in life really are free. And that life led with a sense of purpose, meaning, and love, and thinking of others beyond the self, reaching outward to have a life that revolves around more than just oneself, is really the path to fulfillment. And also health and longevity, which I can talk about, but I don't want to, go on for too long here.
Yes, I actually definitely want to get to health and longevity, but something in what you just said caught my attention. I mean, a lot of it caught my attention, but there was something I wanted to follow up on, because it's kind of an intricate balance, isn't it? There's the problem of being just obsessed with yourself and feeling that incredible sense of inner impoverishment and always trying to fill it. Mm-hmm. And so the remedy, so to speak, is to learn to really focus on others and just find ourselves in others and be able to recognize our connection and so on. And then there are the people, it seems, who focus, if not exclusively, certainly a lot on others and really neglect themselves and
yes.
and that sense of self-care. So it's some kind of intricate balance in there.
Absolutely. And you talk about that so beautifully in your book, Real Love. And that's something that needs to not be forgotten too. So in an aspiration to be there for others and that joy, that fulfillment that comes with it, we know it comes. You cannot forget yourself, because if you forget the self-care, the self-compassion, you pay the price too. You also will burn out, and that's why we often hear about compassion fatigue and things like that, or even parent burnout, any kind of burnout that can come from caregivers, those who take care of those with Alzheimer's and so forth. There's a very fine line and a fine balance to be met here where self-care is needed. And it's not a selfish thing. It's actually profoundly healing and allows you to be there, you know, so much at such a greater capacity for love and caring and joy and upliftment of others.
Yeah, I, you know, of course, completely agree. And I'm curious, when you were working with veterans, when you were doing that research, which I'd love for you to describe some, did you also work with people who were caregivers for veterans, either family members or professional people?
I have taught caregivers of veterans who sometimes will then suffer from something called secondary post-traumatic stress. And I experienced that to a smaller degree in the sense that when I was interviewing the veterans for my study, I was interviewing back to back to back all day long, and they were clinical interviews, and you do hear some terrible, terrible, terrible things, terrible traumas, and you hear a lot of them all day long for days at a time, and I really experienced just a very, very small experience of what a healthcare provider may be experiencing on a daily basis. And I could understand how that might lead to secondary trauma, because some of those images they shared with me stayed in my mind. So definitely it's so important for them. And then spouse is the same thing. I know a spouse whose husband partook in our program. He got better. And as soon as he got better, his spouse lost her lost her mind, for lack of a better term. I mean, she got very anxious. She got agoraphobia. She couldn't go outside. She was, she couldn't be social. She couldn't leave her house. All of a sudden, and he called me and said, "I don't know what's going on. I've been doing well, holding up the family, taking care of our child, and now all of a sudden I'm falling apart."
Yeah, yeah.
And it's normal. You know, all of a sudden you can fall apart and you can let yourself heal from everything you've been carrying for these years of dealing with his trauma and the challenges on your marriage and family.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it as well in the, you know, relatively small amount of work I've done with veterans and families. There was, in one case, the wife, and in a most striking case, the mother of a severely injured soldier. And they were both, especially the mom, going like a billion miles an hour, and they'd had to try to control medical care and benefits and all kinds of things. And I was listening to them and I thought, boy, if they ever slow down, well, like, it would be a lot to face, you know, tremendous grief and sorrow and so much. And of course, we can, as human beings, we do have a capacity to not alone, but necessarily, but often in community and through inner strengths, be with all kinds of conditions in a state of love.
Absolutely. And in those situations where you have to be there for someone else because no one else is, you do enter sort of a fight or flight response. It's your stress response that's keeping you afloat, that's giving you the energy to deal with the crisis at hand. And yet there's only so long that that can help you, because after a while your systems do crash, your body, your nervous system, your immune function, all of those things do end up getting very burdened by that. So important to remember that when we know of caretakers, when we see the people around us, many of them will start complaining of anxiety, and that's normal because they're in that fight or flight response. So so much support is needed for them as well.
So what was your research with the veterans? What were you studying?
Well, at the time that we started our research study with Dr. Richard Davidson, we were looking around, and really the treatments were not, that were out there, the traditional treatments were not really meeting the veterans' needs. Some of them were being helped, and many were not. About 50% of veterans who go through traditional treatment, either drug or therapeutic, come out the other side and there's no change for them. And then there are a lot of veterans who end up dropping out, and then there's those veterans who unfortunately choose the path of self-harming or self-destruction. And so we wanted to meet those veterans whose needs are not being met and see if we could offer them an alternative. And we wanted to offer some kind of contemplative practice. And yet we also found that with high anxiety, sometimes just closing your eyes and sitting there, meditation can be very triggering, very difficult, or even impossible when anxiety is extremely high, which it is often case with trauma. So we chose a breathing-based practice, which is based in the tradition of yoga, called Sudarshan Kriya Yoga, which is offered through Project Welcome Home Truth, a nonprofit. And The breath is powerful, as Sharon, you know so well. Mm-hmm. It goes right into the nervous system. We can calm our heart rate and our blood pressure in minutes just by lengthening our exhales. And the veterans could see a result right away. They're a very practical population. They're a show me. Mm-hmm. They have a show me attitude, and they're kind of a no BS crowd. And so if they see results right away, they may stick with you. Otherwise, you know, they don't have time for you. And, you know, within minutes, they're like, oh, I haven't felt this calm in years. You know, they can tell. Mm-hmm. So they did end up sticking with the program. Most of them, 90% stayed, which is actually very, very high percentage. Yeah. And after a week of practicing this breathing technique, they were able to, their anxiety was normalized, and a year later it was still normalized, and showing that there was some kind of acute benefit of the breathing, even though many of them didn't continue practicing afterward, although one of them did become an instructor of it and is now teaching other veterans, which is really awesome. But there is real healing to be found in contemplative practices that can be quite profound and can help normalize you. In a sense, it wasn't so much healing as a return to normal, a return to who they were, and that's mm-hmm. what they say often. I'm who I was before I left for Iraq. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. So the healing power of breath. And the Sudarshan Kriya Yoga is also offered through Art of Living in the general community. Mm-hmm. But for veterans, it's free of charge through Project Welcome Home Troops, and that's really awesome. If you know any veterans, or anybody listening, mm-hmm, to us. Mm-hmm.
That's fabulous. That's really great. I'm also struck by kind of the almost like the irony that of science and love, because in part, mm-hmm. what you're researching, I would say, even if you're not calling it that, is connection. You know, helping, yes, people reconnect to themselves, connect to the larger world, connect to one another in a different way.
Yes.
If I was up against the wall and I had to define love or real love in, you know, seconds, I would say connection. Yes. A very real or profound sense of connection.
Yes, and we know from the research that social connection, after food and shelter, it's our greatest need. From birth through old age, it predicts psychological well-being, it predicts physical health, it predicts recovery from disease, longevity, and it is such a profound need for us, and yet we're seeing that one out of four Americans has no one to talk to. Mm. One out of four Americans say they have no one to talk to about a personal problem, and the majority of Americans say they have only one person. And so you've got to think, wow, like, there, you know, I always just think it's always worth it to smile at the person at the cash register or to reach out to someone. You just never know who's that 25% of the population. And, you know, the other thing also is we know that a lack of social connection is or profound loneliness is equivalent to smoking and obesity and high blood pressure and on health and well-being and longevity. However, here's the good news, and what relates to your work, Sharon, is that the social connection I'm talking about has nothing to do with how many friends people have. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with how connected you feel on the inside. Do you feel belongingness with mm-hmm. those around you? And mm-hmm. that is where what you teach is so profound, because you are, through the practices you're teaching and through the beautiful book you wrote, bringing people's awareness to how they can feel connected mm-hmm. from within. And it starts, and you know, you beautifully say, with connection to yourself. And so we know, so you can be in New York City, know nobody, but feel connected to everyone. Or you could be a socialite at a party where you know everyone and you feel lonely in a crowd. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with what's going on inside. And so, and you're giving people tools for how to be connected on the inside.
And what I discovered, thank you, and I really, I felt like I kind of crowdsourced the book in a way, and then I tried to speak to so many people and really sought stories and experiences, life experiences from people. And, you know, what I also heard a lot was that you could be lying in bed next to somebody and feel very lonely.
Yes.
You could be, you know, at the dinner table with people you've known, you know, your whole life and feel very lonely. And in a moment, it's not like a strategic effort or something that's highly rehearsed or anything like that. In a moment, you can feel a sense of connection.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, this is just from personal experience, but whenever I do feel loneliness, and I've felt it a few times. I mean, you know, at the beginning when I moved to China by myself at 21, I felt lonely. Mm-hmm. It was probably legitimate. Like, I literally had no one to talk to.
Yeah.
and I couldn't speak the language. Uh-huh. But nowadays, when I feel lonely, I usually have to check in with myself and ask, how's your self-care been lately?
Yeah.
And usually it hasn't been that great. Because if my self-care has been good, I don't feel lonely. And I realize now it has everything to do with, am I a friend to me? If I'm a friend to me, I'm not lonely. Mm-hmm. If I haven't been a friend to me, I feel lonely. It's quite funny.
You know, going back to something you said earlier, which is kind of a pivotal part of my book, is that the development of love and compassion for yourself is not a selfish act. We think of it as being self-centered or self-preoccupied, or people say you should see my to-do list or how many people I have to take care of. I can't spend the time, say, offering love mm-hmm. to myself, or even meditating, which is an act of self-care. And, mm-hmm. But you think about that. You know, what about when we feel depleted and exhausted and overcome and just like so shattered by things? And what wherewithal or inner resource do we have to give to somebody else or offer to somebody else? And so it's not that. On the other hand, I argue in the book that I don't think we necessarily have to love ourselves completely in order to love somebody else, you know, and mm-hmm, then yeah. it becomes this sort of massive project and
right.
This idea of perfectionism once more rears its head.
Right. And also it's hard. I think it's hard to conceptualize what that even means.
Yeah.
I think it's easier to conceptualize, like, have I paid attention to my sleep, my food, and my, you know, my whatever self-care it is that you do, whether it's a bath, meditation, a walk in nature, mm-hmm. Have I been paying attention to, like, those little steps are already much easier to conceptualize than self-love can seem so amorphous.
And it's so funny, you know, that because of the kind of large pop associations with the word love, you know, romance, mm-hmm. and yeah. like this very funny moment in the life of my preparing to write this book on love was when an editor said to me, the love market is saturated. You know, like, it's too much yeah. already. So, you know, and really those books tend to be about relationship and how to find one and how to perfect one and
yes.
even how to lose one, you know, in a skillful way. But it's not only romance that love is about. And so that's why I was thinking of the irony of the word science and the word love kind
yes.
of going together.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, and the thing with science too is that it really only measures such a small portion of anything.
Mm-hmm.
We know much less than we experience in life. And so, you know, all that science can really do is categorize certain aspects of love. And but it encapsulates so little of what the actual experience is, because the experience of love is sometimes, there's sometimes no words for it. It's mm-hmm. so, it's so profound, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, really it's inexpressible in so many ways, and yet we try.
I think though, what you talk about it with regard to self-love is so important, in your book, Real Love, because I think many people struggle with that, if not the majority of people, no matter what crowd you're in. Whenever you ask who here is self-critical, almost everyone raises their hand. Not that there's anything wrong with being self-aware, but when by self-critical, I mean, are you beating yourself up? And most people are. And if you look at the impact of having self-love on your relationships with others, on your health, well-being, and so forth, it's just such an important message, at least in the West, at least in our society. I'm really hoping a lot of people hear it.
Does science tell us that love or connection, the sense of connection, diminishes the experience of physical pain? And does it tell us that it can make us healthier? I mean, how does that work?
It's very interesting, because a lot of people struggle with pain, and yet we also know that pain has a lot of psychological correlates. It has a lot of psychosomatic in many ways, and oftentimes anger, correlates highly with physical pain, and we store emotions in our body in certain ways. And so we ran a small study at Stanford looking at the impact of loving kindness meditation on pain patients, and we found that it decreased their anger and improved their relationships and therefore improved their pain. Now, this is a small study, but there's another study actually that also was conducted looking at the impact of loving kindness meditation on pain. So I think, you know, there are some really interesting things to think about with regard to our sense of connection, the health of our relationships, and our the health of our hearts, mm-hmm. and our physical well-being.
Well, another word that is often misunderstood is happiness. So I'm sure you faced that a lot when you were first out speaking about your book, and the confusion about the different kinds of happiness. And here too, it's this idea that, oh, that's just endless pleasure seeking. That's being conflict avoidant. That's being unwilling to look at the tremendous pain and suffering that can exist and does exist in this world. And so you've been down that path, I'm sure, quite a lot.
Yes. And, you know, on the one hand, happiness is, again, something unfathomable, inexpressible, something you know when you're feeling it and you know when you're not feeling it. But on the other hand, when I'm asked, what's your personal definition of happiness? I say, you know, taking care, being of service in the world, and balancing that with self-care. That is my personal definition, because both in what I've seen in the science, what I've seen in my life, what I've seen in other people's life, that seems to be the key to fulfillment. And it makes so much sense, evolutionarily speaking, because we know we're extremely social creatures. Darwin said we could not have survived if we didn't have each other. We are profoundly connected. We need connection. And at the same time, when we're living in increased isolation right now, people are living further and further from each other. Loneliness is the number one reason people are seeking out therapy. We're facing a crisis of loneliness. And we're wondering why there are so many cases of anxiety and depression and so forth. But we're also facing a crisis of lack of connection. So I think the message, again, of connect, belong, care for others, be compassionate, and also remember self-compassion, mm-hmm. self-care, self-kindness, self-love. It's profound. That balance, to me, is the key.
And balance, I think one of the issues with balance is that it's a complex, intricate state. It's not static. Mm-hmm. It's always moving. It's always changing. And it's not the same. I mean, as a parent, the balance of caring for others and caring for oneself is a certain thing, right? And always in flux.
Always in flux. I mean, for me, before I was pregnant, I was doing a lot of community service. I was teaching at a VA hospital in San Diego, really enjoying being able to be of service to the veterans there. And yet, once I had my baby, I realized, okay, I can't go and do that anymore because I have a lot of responsibility here. While I still teach and so forth, I can't do it as much. I can't do it every week the way I was. So I'm finding a new balance there. And then, of course, the self-care balance is very tricky in parenting, and that I had to learn a whole new set of skills there. I mean, just with the basics, you know, am I sleeping enough? Yeah. Am I eating appropriately? Like those very basic things that you don't ask yourself when you're not also caregiving.
Mm-hmm. I did a Skype session with a friend's yoga teacher training group in California. And mm-hmm. I was trying to describe the term equanimity, which is one of those words that's very confusing. It sounds to us often like indifference or apathy or not caring or coldness. Within the Buddhist psychology, equanimity really means balance. And it's in the case of relationship, it's the balance born of wisdom, you know, so we might have maybe hopefully incredible compassion towards someone, and also wisdom that tells us, you know what, I'll do everything I can to try to make things better, and I'm not in control. I can't make someone change. And so I said that the example that is sometimes written about in the Buddhist texts is a parent whose child is now an adult, and there's enormous love and connection and caring, and at the same time the parent realizes, I can't control them. I can't just make them over into having the life I want them to have. And apparently there's a tremendous number of people in the room who had young children, and they all started like raising their hand and saying loudly, no, no, it's not just older kids. It's not just, you know, adult kids. It's it's young kids too. There's the love and there's the letting go all at the same time.
Yep. Very poignant lessons of life that can be very painful and yet are accompanied by hopefully growth and wisdom, like that ability to let go. You're always letting go. And I think that is also a profound key to happiness, but also to healthy relationships, being able to love and not cling.
Yeah, so there's one of the clues about differentiating what I might call real love and what would ordinarily be more a state of attachment. Not attachment in the current sort of Western psychological mode of, like, you know, you want appropriate attachment, you don't want disordered attachment or whatever, but attachment more in the sense of control, wanting to be in control, or feeling the need to be in control, which is, you know, if love is generosity, it's like generosity of the spirit, not leaving oneself out, but including oneself, then when we add in that element of wanting to be in control, it is something else altogether. It's no longer in any way a freely given gift.
Yes, absolutely. And yet, if you are that kind of partner in whatever relationship it is, you are a wonderful partner, truly. Because I've experienced that even in partnerships, just how my current husband is loving and yet he's not clingy, he's not controlling, and that is, I experience that as not only true love but also as profound respect.
Uh-huh. How beautiful.
And that combination, I think, is very powerful, because you feel free and yet you feel loved, and therefore you feel more, you actually feel more attached, right, than if someone were trying to control you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I believe very strongly in moment by moment change. You know, I don't discount those moments when we're really there, just because we are then swamped by our fears or concerns or whatever might, you know, come up, because we can keep returning. And that's why the essence of my teaching of meditation practice, whatever method, is really being able to begin again, to let go of what has made us disconnected, what's overwhelmed us or distracted us, to be able to let go of that. And we can always, always begin again. And I think that's how transformation happens. It may not happen in the great breakthrough experience we want, where we say, oh, at 2:15, I love myself completely. It's all done now. Or, you know, I've forgiven everyone in my life. Thank goodness. And it's not like that. It's moments and moments and moments, and we're always having to begin again.
Yeah, always having to learn again and again. Even currently, I mean, one of the struggles I'm having with my 2-year-old is that I want to be there for him and really be loving and affectionate, and at the same time, he's entering a phase where he's crying a lot and a lot of tantrums, and he's trying to get his way, like, oh, when mommy's around, he's like, I don't have to sit in my chair and eat, and I don't have to, because she'll be there if I cry. And so I'm now learning, what do I do? And I had this dream, and I don't often pay attention to my dreams, but this one was kind of a lesson for me, where I dreamt of a cow, which I usually think of as very gentle animal. To me, it's like the maternal animal, right? They give us milk. We basically drink their breast milk, and they are gentle. They don't hurt. They don't harm. They're just very docile, warm, loving creatures. And so in this dream, I saw her, and I was petting her, and she was so soft and so loving and so gentle. And as I put my hand on her neck, I felt she's unwielding. Like, I think we've all put our hands on the neck of a horse or a cow and felt that muscle, right? It's so powerful that I woke up thinking, wow, like, you can be loving and warm and gentle and unwielding and strong and powerful too.
Yeah. How wonderful. So one of the explorations of love, it seems, is how can we sit in the heart of, if not ambiguity, bringing in a lot of different elements together that on the face of it can seem contradictory, but they're really not. They really complement one another. That's balance.
That's balance. And when that balance is there, the self-love is there, right?
Yeah.
The cow in that symbol, like that unwielding neck, is also a sign of, and I will keep grazing if I want to, or I will do whatever I need to do to take care of myself too, you know?
Now, I'm wondering also, when you say you were doing the research with the veterans and you were working with caregivers, did your definition or your sense of what love was shift or change?
Actually, you know, Sharon, for me, that I've been working on the self-love part for a long time, because I've always felt a need to give back and caring and being of service is something I've always wanted. It sort of drives my life. That's just what I want to do with my time. That's where I feel happiest, and that's where I just feel like blessed as a person, and I just want to be able to help others feel better if I can. So I've always been motivated by that, but then I always have to be careful with the burnout part, the self-love part, right? Mm-hmm. So, which is in part why I wrote my book, from some of the lessons I learned, but also, you know, when I was working on that study, I was also going through a divorce, and I was very lonely, actually, and I cared deeply about the study. I cared deeply about the veterans, and there were a number of obstacles that were thrown in my way from various places, and it was so shocking to me, because here I was like, I'm just trying to do the study. Well, you know, and these obstacles were being thrown in front of my feet all the time. I had to push my way through, and at the same time, I really, at that time, you know, I lost a lot of weight, and I couldn't sleep. I was getting some of the trauma symptoms, in fact, so immersed in their world, and I realized, wow, like I really need to balance that and keep taking care. And so it was, I learned about the balance you talk about so much. So, and how important that is.
Well, it's really fascinating. You know, I spend, I don't know if it's like a larger proportion of my time. It's certainly a very powerful and fulfilling portion of my time working with caregivers of different kinds. I was part of this four-year program through the Garrison Institute in Garrison, New York, working with domestic violence shelter workers, and that program has sort of evolved to working with international humanitarian aid workers, and then there's the stuff I do just as the invitations arise, you know, a VA hospital here or prison there, or, you know, school teachers or people who will come to just an open retreat or workshop who really come from a tremendous number of, you know, walks of life and livelihoods and so on. And I've just been watching kind of the current wave of interest in empathy training in this country, which we sorely need, I believe, as a nation, no doubt. But I keep thinking, well, I've worked with a lot of people who have plenty of empathy, you know, really extraordinary empathy. They're burning out for some other reason. So, what would be of service to them? You know, what would be a contribution to their well-being? Not more empathy training, for sure, but something else.
Yeah, and well, it's interesting, too. When we're looking at data with physicians and healthcare providers, and their burnout rate is 50%. It's very high. It starts in medical school, by the way. But one of the reasons that the data points to is that they're actually not allowed to express their empathy because they have to move from one person to the next. Mm. So, hey, sorry, you've got 3 months to live. Okay, on to the next one. You know, they're not actually given the time for the human moment. And when you're not given the time for the human moment, it actually makes you burn out faster, because all of a sudden they're turned into these sort of robotic figures, pharmacists or surgeons, basically, is what they end up having as a role. And the human moment is completely removed. And that actually harms them tremendously. And that's what the data is showing. And yet when the healthcare providers are allowed and able to show empathy and compassion, we see that patients tend to return less into the emergency room. They tend to heal better and faster. Wow. So it's just tremendous when you look at this impact of and the necessity for empathy. And of course, at the same time, like we've been talking about, that need for self-care is essential, whatever that is, in order for all of these professions to be able to balance the tremendous work they're doing and their ability to stay sane, really.
So I just want to take a moment to take that in. So the care provider themselves feels more whole because they've gotten a chance to express it, and the patient or the recipient seems to be healthier, so they're quite affected by that moment of expression as well.
Yes, and yet, you know, how many of us have gone to the doctor's office and they don't even look in your eyes, they're just looking at your charts and the computer screen, and you feel, where is the healer aspect in that relationship? It's a transactional relationship between a pharmacist or a surgeon and you, but it's not, there's no, it's transaction, it's not a, like a real exchange. And if you think about traditional forms of medicine, Tibetan medicine or Ayurvedic medicine or other forms where the doctor lays their hands on you, like they listen to your pulse. I mean, in Tibetan medicine, this seems shocking to people, but it's so intimate that they actually taste the flavor of your urine mm-hmm. to see what's going on. I mean, it's profoundly intimate, and yet it can seem very, it can seem primitive to a Western mind, and yet there's something to be said about touching your patient, maybe not physically, but looking at them. Dr. Doty, who's the director of our Center of Compassion at Stanford, he often tells the story of how 80% of the patients coming in through his door don't need back surgery. They've made it all the way into a neurosurgeon's office at Stanford University, and he sends them away. He said they needed someone to hold them. They needed someone to listen to them. They needed a hug. And yet everyone else has proceeded to send them up the line to get surgery.
Well, so when I wrote Real Love, it has three sections. The first section is about cultivating love for oneself and what a good idea that is. And, you know, and of course the meditations and exercises. And then the second section is about love for an other, whether it's a partner or a friend or a client or colleague, you know, parent, child, dog. And then the third section is about love for all beings everywhere, basically the culminating in love for life itself. And so for some people, I know that really profound sense of connection to all of life happens not even through the sense of beings, but through nature. And I wanted to hear your views on that, the kind of connection, even awe, sense of wonder that we can develop, sense of greater belonging that we can develop through nature.
Well, nature is, we know that just being out in nature decreases our anxiety or depression and improves our well-being dramatically, and yet we often forget that, and so we don't actually go and spend time in nature. But one of the ways it does so is by increasing our feeling of awe, which is definitely something that is being researched currently. But also, if you're in nature, you're in a place of connection. If you walk through the woods, everything is connected. The trees are connected. I mean, everything. It's not like you intellectually have to fathom it or think about it. You're experiencing it because all of a sudden you're part of it too. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the understanding that we get in nature is not intellectual. It's visceral. Mm-hmm. It's intuitive, for lack of a better word. And research does show that when we spend time in nature, we do feel more connection to others. What is it about it? And one hypothesis is that we're really going back to where our ancestors lived up to only 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've always been in nature, and now we're living further and further and less naturally than ever. But when we do spend time there, we remember who we really are and how connected we really are.
So I'm in New York City right now. I don't know if you can hear the sirens. So does looking at the sky count? Or
I think that looking at
plants?
The sky.
I don't know. What can I do?
Yes, I think plants definitely helps, and the sky definitely broadens our perspective. Because sometimes when we're sitting between four walls with a screen or tablet in front of us, our perspective is definitely shortened. And in fact, research shows that in Japan, 90% of the kids have myopia because they're always looking at a very short distance in front of them, whereas looking at a longer distance, like when you're in nature and you're looking out on the horizon, really improves actually your physical perspective. But I think that can also shift your mind. I mean, you can do some beautiful meditations just looking at the sky.
I mean, I think that's great because there's also a book that I quote in my book, which I think is it's a great book, although if you chose to, you don't have to go beyond the title, which is so great, which is Bowling Alone.
Yeah.
And it's about the breakdown of different social institutions like bowling leagues, where we used to meet one another. And it's certainly in these days when people talk about how do you get together and have any kind of conversation with somebody where you're coming from different political points of view. Maybe it used to be the bowling league, and there are not so many of those anymore. So between the breakdown of certain institutions and the lack of kind of nature in a lot of people's lives and the sort of cutthroat environment where in, and I think very fundamentally, the places we're taught happiness is to be found. You know, so the ways we do devote our time and our energy to getting happier could be sadly mistaken. Between all of that, it seems like we need something kind of radically different in order to go on, not just each of us ourselves, but as a society.
Yeah, it's both radically different what we need, and also extremely natural. And it's basically coming back to who we are, coming back to our roots, which is connection to one another, which is a pace of life that's more in line with our circadian rhythm, with the nature, where we're living in a more natural way. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like brain science is needed here, yet we need it somehow to buy this.
We seem to need it for meditation as well, which is, I'd add, because I believe, you know, obviously so strongly in kind of the skills training aspect of meditation, you know, that it is totally natural. You know, we think of it as woo-woo and weird sometimes, or esoteric and so different, but it is completely natural. And yet it's we've lost touch with certain skills about presence and balance and awareness and love, which in itself could be seen as a kind of skill. Mm-hmm. You know, to the degree that love or connection comes from paying attention differently, we know attention certainly can be trained. That's what meditation is. And so we need to sort of look at how we spend our time and see if some of that cultivation or that commitment, you know, to the different elements of life that we know will, or we suspect will, make us a lot happier and stronger, and actually put them into practice.
Absolutely. And it really shouldn't be that foreign, because if you look at any child, do they have that? Like a child, a baby, like they're full of love. They're full of attention. They're full of wonder. They're full of connection. They don't care if they know your name. They'll feel connected to you if you play with them, or they just, there's a sense of belongingness that's there. And if they have, children have it, we all have it, because we all were children once. So it's less a question of training as undoing, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So as part of this podcast series, I'm asking everybody, what word comes to mind for you when you think about love?
One word only.
Well, you can give me more than one word.
Yeah. You know, like I was saying earlier, it's compassion and self-compassion, that combination.
All right, thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we close?
I just wanted to share, you know, the results of the study we conducted on the loving kindness meditation. You provided us when I was a graduate student at Stanford, and just the results that we found was that in 7 minutes alone, the participants felt connected to strangers, more connected than another group that did, you know, different variations of meditation that were just not real meditations, different visualizations, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so just how quickly you can shift from within through these types of practices, how nurturing they are. I remember one participant, he was in the other room and we could hear what was going on, and I had a little video just to make sure everything was going right and I could see what was going on. And all of a sudden he's in the middle of the meditation and I hear, "Oh yeah." And I look over and he's just blissed out, feeling the love. Share that.
I'm thrilled. That's so wonderful. So thank you so much for being here today. It's really, it's always great to talk to you. And it's great to dwell in these worlds of love.
Yes, it's really my profound pleasure and favorite topic.
Mine too. So anybody who's listening, you can learn more about Emma's work by visiting her website at emmasepala, that's emmasepala.com. And I really recommend that you get a copy of her book, The Happiness Track. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. Join us this summer for the Real Love Challenge. To get your copy of Real Love, visit SharonSalzberg.com. May all beings be happy.